This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one!
It's the Politics Show cast.
Hello, Andy. For people who might not be familiar with who you are, how would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, I'm Andy Burnham, Mayor of Gracemanchester, but also a published author. I never thought I would say that, but today's the day.
Highbrow stuff, a thinker, public.
I'm not sure how intellectual.
A public intellectual.
Well, I'm not sure I'd say that, nor would I say highbrow. It's a bit middle to lowbrow, I think. It's half memoir, half manifesto. So myself and Steve Rotherham, the Mayor of Liverpool, we've kind of opened up a bit on our childhoods and past, and but we've turned it into a bit of a plan for the country. So Head North, hope people like it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. That's the new book, Head North, a rallying cry for a more equal Britain. I mean, can you tell us about when you first kind of became conscious of the idea that a North-South divide existed? When, in your own words, you began to feel that England was, in fact, two different countries?
Well, I can name the day. It was the 15th of April, 1989. And that's where the book starts, because though I was born in Liverpool and kind of moved over to Manchester and my dad got a job there, I always kept my allegiances with Everton, lifelong Evertonian. I was at Villa Park watching Everton versus Norwich in one semi-final. In those days, they kicked off at the same time and Liverpool were playing Forest at Hillsborough and Steve was there. So though we didn't know each other, we were both at those semi-finals that day. Loads of my friends were at Hillsborough. I had been at Hillsborough the year before and had the most uncomfortable 90 minutes I've ever had at a football match because of the way that ground had people in those pens. And that was the day that changed everything. And that's what we call the first chapter, because we knew that ground was unsafe. The night before, I was in the pub discussing it with friends. Can't believe you're in that away end again. And obviously, within days of that happening, the government of the country, the media of the country, turned on Liverpool, its supporters, the city, the North, and basically tried to blame them. And that was the time. That had a radicalizing effect on me as a young man. I was at Cambridge University at the time. I went back to Cambridge after being at home for my Easter holidays and went to the semi-finals. Got to Cambridge, no one was even talking about it. And if they were, they were just parroting what the the lies that some of the media had come out with. And that was when, to answer your question, I realized this country was in fact two countries.
We'll come back to this point, right, about identity and the separation there. But I just want to fast forward, because obviously you become a politician. And for people who aren't familiar, there is a there's a clip, right? I mean, you go and you deliver a speech in front of the fans and you're kind of, well, I don't want to describe it to you. I just encourage people to go and watch it, but you're kind of getting heckled, shouted at, and there's this really sort of defining moment. I think that, well, actually, I just invite you to walk us through what's happening, right? When you go to give that speech, tell me what happens.
Well, if the 15th of April, 1989 was the day that got me into politics, the 15th of April, 2009 was the day that took me out of Westminster politics, because Steve, who was Lord Mayor of Liverpool at the time, was adamant that I had to come to Anfield on the 20th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster as culture secretary in Gordon Brown's government and address the COP. And I was saying to him in the run-up, Steve, what can I say? What can I say? He says, you just have to be there. And it kind of prompted something of a personal crisis because I knew as I was in a government that hadn't done anything for people. And yet, in my heart, I knew I had to be there. And it was my younger brother, John, who just said to me, look, and go if you're going to do something for the families. If you're not, don't go. So I kind of made a decision to go. And I kind of made a bit of a mental break, really, with the sort of Westminster way of doing things, you know, going there and mouthing a few platitudes. I decided to throw everything I had at reopening Hillsborough, basically. And it was, yeah, but I, you know, in some ways it was a relief when those cries for justice came off the COP, because I was like sort of there with a knot in my stomach, just sort of waiting for something to give on that day. Something had to give on that day. The way I describe it is, you know, when I walked out to face the COP that day, I kind of walked to the edge of the abyss between the government that I was in and the people I'd grown up with. And it was basically the time when I then sort of started to take my steps out of Westminster to what I'm doing now.
I think that's a theme that's probably going to crop up a little bit in this interview, no doubt. Let's, like I said, then let's go back. Tell me, growing up in the North, tell me how in the 80s that kind of influenced your politics and your personal identity.
Well, it really did, because, you know, it was a tough time. There was a programme called Boys and the Black Stuff, which was about the decline of Liverpool and the North. News at 10 every night used to have a sort of ticker where it would have the job losses across the, it would like rack them up on us. So, yeah, it's hard to believe that now. But, you know, how could you not be a bit sort of like despondent and you know, no hope around? And I was growing up in the Lee area, which I came on to represent as an MP. But, you know, that was the heart of the Lancashire coalfield. So the miners' strike was massive when I was at school. Loads of my friends had dads who worked in the mines. And that was, you know, all of this was kind of, you know, giving you this political awakening. But Steve and I are really conscious to make sure that this book is not seen as one long northern wind. Oh, it was so hard and this, that, you know, the kind of stereotypes. We all know it. Outside toilets, blah-de-blah. Actually, we also, though, contrast some of that really tough stuff that was happening with the fact that the northwest of England was bossing the world when it comes to music and football. So, you know, as I've said, I was an Everton supporter. We were the best team in Europe in the mid-1980s. And the bands of the era, I can't tell you, Ollie, what an effect they had on us, particularly for me, the Smiths in the sort of mid-80s, sort of going into 86, 87. You know, I quote a line from Hand in Glove in the book. Yes, we may be hidden by rags, but we have something they'll never have. And the thing about that line is, it's kind of how I felt when I finally got to university. You know, I had all of this imposter syndrome about getting to Cambridge and could I, you know, survive there and all the rest of it. And then I'd walk into people's bedrooms and see these Smiths posters all over these sort of students from all these private schools' walls. I was like, hang on a minute, you've got a Salford Lads Club poster up there. And I'd seen the Smiths at Salford University on the Queen is Dead tour before I went to Cambridge. And that kind of made me feel, well, hang on a minute, we do have something that they want and they can't have, you know, and it kind of gave us a confidence then about our identity and the Northwest and, you know, maybe weren't so bad after all. You know, I disagree with many of the things he says now. You know, Morrissey had quite a big impact, really, in terms of my generation at the time in the Northwest, sort of, you know, thinking, well, we can be better than this. He's telling us we can be better than this. And yeah, that was quite a contrast, really, kind of bleak on the sort of economic front. But in terms of the identity that came through football and music and culture, well, fashion, well, that was absolutely massive.
There has been kind of a attempts at a national political level, right, to try and bridge this gap that you're talking about, to close that divide between the two. I mean, it feels like ancient history now, but, you know, 2019, leveling up, we all heard it, we know about it, and we'll all remember the press conferences with you as well during COVID, right? I mean, do you think the Conservatives' policy of leveling up has had a real impact when it comes to closing that divide? Do you think it's just a load of kind of hot air? I mean, what's your reviews of it so far?
Oh, well, it is mixed, and I'm always trying to give credit where it's due. And yes, they have, if you like, created devolution in England. So let's give them that in the kind of plus column. It's now irreversible. There are mayors across large parts of England now. The North East is about to get a combined mayor. North Yorkshire, East Midlands. So this map is filling in now. And that is irreversible, and that's a credit to them, because this country politically has been very sort of Westminster-centric. All the political power was held there, and that's one of the reasons why we're so unequal. So that's a good thing. But you come to that phrase, levelling up. Well, it began, if you remember, as the Northern powerhouse a decade ago. That's where they started with this. And that phrase implied a priority to be given to the North. The North, too far behind, Northern powerhouse, public funds will go there as a priority. Okay, we backed it. We were sceptical if they ever really meant it, but we backed it. Theresa May then added the Midlands engine to that to sort of dilute it a bit. And then it became levelling up under Boris Johnson, and we were becoming more sceptical about it. And then they cancel HS2 and give the money to fill potholes in London last year. And then you might say the sort of coup de grace yesterday in the budget, £242 million, no less, given as levelling up funding to Canary Wharf. Now, Ollie, I put it to you, does Canary Wharf need levelling up? Isn't it sort of levelled up enough already?
I think it might need a little bit of levelling down, if anything, Andy, to be quite honest with you.
It's just, I mean, it's kind of become like they're trolling us, if you know what I mean, that they kind of throw Network North, oh yes, we're doing these things for you, and they're spending money in sort of Plymouth and Bognor Regis, and, you know, it's basically, I think, become discredited as a movement. It began with really good intentions, and I have often given George Osborne public credit for the whole Northern Powerhouse initiative that he's still committed to it, because he's still part of the Northern Powerhouse partnership to get serious. But in typical Westminster fashion, it has become a sort of thing that has been adulterated. It's been, the spin has come in, the slogans, the con. And I just think people up here are looking at it all and thinking, do you think we are daft? Do you think you can just constantly treat us that way, as though we're always second class citizens when it comes to transport? If anything, they've probably just kind of fueled the sort of the feeling that we're going to demand it. And Head North hopefully is pitching into this moment where, you know, we've been promised it, we've not been given it. And actually now the feeling is growing for real change in this country, and definitely real change is the call that's coming from the north of England.
Before you became a Metro Mayor, you write in the book that you sort of became an MP with a mission to close that the divide that we've just been talking about. And not only that, actually, you become a minister, right, in Tony Blair's government.
Yeah.
But most indicators point to the fact that the new Labour government failed to reduce the gap, right, despite a renewal of interest in kind of regional economic performance. I mean, why was that? What's your analysis of why the Labour government that you were a part of failed to do it as well?
Because Labour's London-centric. And as far as I have observed in my time in it, it always has been. And if I'm honest, it still is. And I've made that criticism over the decades that I've been in the party. And I'm not going to flinch from making it, because it's a truth and it needs to be confronted. Now, that is not to say that the government that I was in did not do some really important things to level up this country. Actually, in a more meaningful way, when you look at child poverty and, you know, what was quite an incredible record on child poverty, even the Northwest, Commonwealth Games in Manchester, Liverpool, Capital of Culture, Media City, the BBC, you know, the really significant things that did contribute to the levelling up to the extent that it's happening. But now, don't flinch from saying that. I remember wincing as a sort of young politician early in the life of that Labour government, where they put this thing out that the North-South divide didn't exist anymore, as though they were trying to sort of play to Middle England or so. I don't know. But, that was one of the first times, and I really sort of like went, what? And kind of felt a bit distanced from the kind of government I was in. I write in the book of my pride in what the Labour government achieved. If I think back to the country in 2010 compared to the country now, well, I am completely sure that it was a much better place. I thank Tony Blair and Gordon Brown for the backing that they gave to me. But my journey through all of that, in the end, convinced me that the north of England will never get justice within the current political system. And that is why it needs to be fundamentally rewired, if that is what you want to see, a more even country where all parts of it have equivalent living standards. And we certainly don't have that now.
Not another one?
It's the Politics Show cast.
On that point, you write that there are parts of the Labour Party that believe the party has to stick with, quote, certain establishment norms if it's to be trusted with power. Keir Starmer belongs to that part of the party, doesn't he?
Well, I hope not, actually, because if you look back to some of the things he's done through his career, I think he's often shown a willingness to take on some of those things. And I want to kind of work with Keir to embolden him to do that in the coming period. There's always been a sort of mantra around Westminster that the public doesn't care about the House of Lords or the Constitution or PR. But actually, I think they do. And I think they can see it more clearly now. COVID revealed to us that the country is not run properly. I keep saying at any one time, about 50 people are running the country. And that, in my view, having been in the cabinet, is the reality.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And that is dysfunctional in normal times. It's dangerous in a pandemic where that small group of people are foisting decisions on millions. And that's what I stood up to during the Tier 3 thing. So I think that everyone in the country saw that in real time, everybody. And everyone could see it being confirmed in the COVID public inquiry. And I think there is a mood, actually, for quite radical change to the way the country is being run. And I think Keir and the Labour Party should tap into that mood. And I think I can't remember in my life a sort of sense of needing quite a very, a big sort of line drawn at this election and a whole new era opened up and, sort of nothing off the table. I think that's where we've reached. Now, we're in a pretty broken state, I would say, right now. And I think the Labour Party should lean into that mood and not shy away from it.
I think there's very few people that would disagree with your remarks there about sort of the broken nature of the country right now. But I want to pick up on a couple of words you said there, right? You use words like hope when talking about Keir Starmer and should. And those are different to saying something like, I have faith in him and we will. And I think about something, to keep it very firmly within this kind of North-South paradigm for a moment, looking at something like a refusal to commit to reversing the cancellation of HS2. And that for me seems to be such an obvious example of something that the Labour Party should be fighting the Conservatives on and should be saying, no, actually, this is a line in the sand for us. We're going to take regional inequality seriously. We think this is an appalling decision and we're going to do something about it when we get in power.
Well, the reason I use those words like hope and could is because I'm just not in the conversations. I'm not in the rooms, am I, where I'm hearing those conversations. I'm more, if you like, detached from those things these days, but I'm supportive from a distance, and I do want to persuade the more ambitious vision. That's my job, isn't it? You know, my job is to push the party to be as ambitious as possible. I've concluded that I can't achieve what I want to achieve for Greater Manchester and the North West without that radical rewiring in Westminster. We could take it so far from what we're doing with devolution, but you can't actually get it all of the way. I mean, on HS2, and it's actually like some of the things announced in the budget yesterday, these things have all been political stunts and traps, i.e., you know, trap Labour on one side of this and we'll go away and spend the money. And, you know, and that's what they've done, by the way. You know, I said before, they took the money and have allocated, they've scattered it. They've scattered it everywhere, including into potholes in London. I mean, that's what they've done. So it's hard, isn't it, for Labour then to keep big ticket commitments when the money that was there has been basically thrown to the four winds. You know? So I realise it's hard. I mean, but my job is to persuade them not to have HS2 back in its potentially quite gold-plated form that it was, but certainly to have son or daughter of HS2, because I can tell you something for nothing. There is absolutely no chance that this country can rely on the West Coast main line between Birmingham and Manchester for connectivity for the rest of this century. The notion that HS2 trains are going to come off HS2 lines north of Birmingham and then go onto the West Coast main line, and that's going to be good enough. We've had it confirmed. They will actually have to go slower because they won't be able to tilt like the Pendolinos, and they'll have fewer seats because they'll have to be 200 metres. Now, after all of this, the north of England ends up with worse train services by the middle of the 21st century. Oh my God. No, I'm sorry. That is not happening. And I will be, you know, throwing everything I've got into persuading Labour to commit to a new line between Manchester and Birmingham. It won't be HS2. I don't think it should be, by the way. I think it is right to sort of reimagine it a little bit. But yeah, this is where we are now at the moment. It's my job actually to not just to sort of get in line and, you know, with the shadow cabinet. That's not my job. You know, my job is to have that ambition for the North, to plead with the party to go that bit further. And, you know, and yeah, that's what I'm here to do. And I will do my job. And I won't actually do the Westminster game anymore where people say, oh, here's the line to take and don't go beyond it. I don't do that. You may have noticed, Ollie, I don't do that anymore. And I think I'm probably a better politician for not doing that.
I wonder if with that distance that you mentioned there, there also comes tension, right? Whether it's yourself, maybe it's Sadiq Khan and the Labour leadership, because, you know, what you're saying about, you know, convincing a sense of ambition and creating a sense of ambition, your policies, you know, like on transport, taking buses into public control, they are more radical than the Central Labour Party. And I wonder, is there a risk potentially of undermining that party, particularly in an election year? Is there a chance that when you try to convince that ambition and create that sense of ambition, there's a possibility you present a disunited front or whatever the sort of the lingo would be within Westminster?
Yeah, there possibly is a risk of that, but it's not what I'm doing. You know, I'm supportive of them. I want to see a Labour government. I want to see Keir as Prime Minister as soon as possible. So yeah, I'm conscious of that. But Sadiq, Anna Sawa, Mark Drakeford, you know, in the recent past, we've all had that role of encouraging the party to go further. And actually, it's part of politics, isn't it, for people to be really connected to their place. And that is part of, you know, rebuilding trust in politics, actually, that people can see politicians who are not kind of caveating everything and kind of, you know, using sort of vague words, actually just speak clearly and directly for the place that you're in. That's part of political renewal, I would say, that we need in this country. But there's a way of doing it, and you can do it in a supportive way. And Steve and I are doing it in a supportive way. The big lesson for Labour, a London-centric Labour, which I said before, which sadly it still is too much, the big lesson is do not try and put devolved entities into sort of the top-down sort of machine, because that's, I would say, how we lost Scotland. When I was in government, there was this feeling that all the Scottish politicians were in London and they were giving orders to Holyrood when Scottish Labour ran it, and it was like the branch office up in Scotland. And that, in the end, I think, created the space for the SNP to come in. So the Labour Party needs to move to a more mature arrangement where it it respects the space that we have as more independent devolved leaders to say what we need to say for our places. And I think that builds a better, healthier political culture in the country.
Let's explore that then, because you are placing pressure on the next government, with Labour or otherwise, with this Head North plan, right? You know, the book outlines it. There are 10 changes, but this includes a kind of Senate of the Nations of the Region, full devolution. I mean, what does that mean in practice?
Well, it means a parliament that reflects all parts of the UK equally, represents them all equally. At the moment, there are more people in the House of Lords who went to school at Eton than were born in Greater Manchester or born in the Liverpool City Region. How much longer are we going to put up with that outrageous state of affairs? Are we honestly going to get to the 2030s? And that is still going to be the case when the regions of England are not equally represented in our national parliament, and it's actually dominated by people who live within the M25. Honestly, are we going to do that? I'm not accepting that. I think it should change tomorrow. And actually, it could be done within a parliament, because we say in the book, you know, there was the plan that Billy Bragg once put forward called the secondary mandate. You can move quickly to a proportional Lords or a Senate, to use the new word, from votes cast at the general election under first past the post. So that could be done by the next general election. And this is what we're saying now. We need to have an urgency about this. The country isn't in a contented state. People feel angry about things. The unfairness is palpable. You know, you look at the transport system in one part of the country, you look at it in another where there's no services at all. This is a recipe for the UK to get ever more fragmented and ever more fractious. And it's not good. We need to hear what people are saying. We need to look at the state of the country. Things feel broken. Politics needs to start fixing things again. And it does start with fixing the wiring of the country and the way power works.
You also turn to Germany as a model for how to address the sort of the North-South divide, especially this idea of basic law. What is basic law, and how, in your view, would it close regional gaps?
Yeah, so a basic law is in what's in the German constitution, and it's a law that requires equivalent living standards between all the 16 Länder of Germany. And we're saying we need a British basic law in a new written constitution for our country. So levelling up can't be a passing slogan. It's actually the national mission, the policy of the country to move to a more equal country. And this is the great irony, Ollie. Britain had a big hand in creating modern Germany. After the Second World War, we created that Länder structure to prevent a concentration of political power in Berlin. And then after the Berlin Wall fell, Germany added that basic law, and now the richer Länder, Bavaria and others, put money into the pot that actually gets redistributed, and that has levelled up East Germany with West Germany. And this is the irony of all ironies. Britain has had a big hand in creating the most levelled up country in the world. Sadly, it's just not our own.
Do you think, I'm conscious that we might be getting too into the weeds here, but looking at recent election results, particularly in the east of Germany, those former communist areas, and the rise of AfD, you know, electorally, people are turning to the far right. Do you think you can say that levelling up's working if that's also happening on an electoral basis?
Well, I think you can if you go there and you experience Germany. You know, you see a level of public infrastructure, transport infrastructure, in all cities that is way beyond what we have got. Germany, like everywhere, is not immune from some of those kind of political sort of trends that are going around the world. But I would say it's more immune than most, because people's living standards are higher, and there isn't that sense of my life's no good and blaming someone else. You know, I think we are because of the levels of inequality in Britain, much more open to more extremist politics coming in, as we're seeing in the US as well. We are the two most unequal countries, the UK and the US, if you look at it from an income point of view. And I think, you know, our politics has become, you know, theirs hasn't become as dysfunctional as ours. And, you know, I think that is partly because there's a more obvious kind of fairness across the country.
As potent a rallying call as ever, then, to address this inequality. I mean, just finally, Andy, is pressure from outside enough to force these changes? I mean, you know where this question's going. Would you ever return to Westminster or otherwise, I don't know, maybe the president of a federal Britain to implement these?
Are you predicting a sequel of this book called Head South in a couple of years' time? Well, I'm about to face the great people of Greater Manchester in an election in 2 months' time. I'm standing because I am so energised by what Steve and I are building. You know, this is a big part of Head North. So there's a piece of what we're doing. It's not like none of it is happening. A big chunk of our 10-point plan is happening. We're doing it. We're building it. And that's really exciting. And it's not finished. You know, I need to finish the change to transport. So we do have a London-style transport system, and that's what we're on the way to getting. But, you know, I will work with anybody, and I haven't ruled out one day maybe going back to see if I can advance some of these thoughts. But I actually, you know, it's a hopeful book, Ollie. It's not a long northern whinge. It's a hopeful book. It's a hopeful book because, you know, devolution in England is irreversible. Change is starting to happen. I think the second quarter of the 21st century is going to be very different in the north of England than the first. I honestly believe that, you know, because there's a level of devolved power now. 90% of the north is going to be covered by an elected mayor and a combined authority by after May, after the elections. That is a new reality. We can start doing more for ourselves. So this isn't a negative book at all. And it finishes on that kind of possibility of net zero being a route to reindustrialize the north of England in a good way. And I'm just waiting for a government to come in and back us to do that. And that's why, you know, I'm sort of here. I'm excited by what we're doing here. But I don't rule out, you know, going back one day.
And just finally, Andy, where and when can people access this long northern whinge? Where can they get it?
I said it wasn't one. it's more than there's a bit of whinging in it. I'm not going to say there's not, but there's lots of music references, football references, some dodgy fashion references, and pictures and haircuts and God knows what. We're not taking ourselves too seriously, I don't think. It is available today in all bookshops, online, Audible, audiobook. You know, it's out there as of today. You know, we hope people like it. And the last point I would make, Ollie, is, for people in the Southwest or the East Midlands or the East Anglia, don't think this is not about you as well, because it is. You know, the same kind of things we want for the North, I can recognise is what people in all of those regions need as well. So it is meant to be a book for everyone. It's trying to speak to the mood of the times. Hope you like it, but, you know, we'll see what people say.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.